Without the ones like you, who work tirelessly to keep things running, everything would suddenly stop. Hospitals, factories, schools, and power plants, they all depend on you. No matter the weather, emergency, or time of day, you're the ones who get it done. At Grainger, we're here for you, with professional-grade industrial supplies. Count on real-time product availability and fast delivery. Call, clickgrainger.com or just stop by. Grainger, for the ones who get it done.
Hello, and welcome to episode 75 of The Ethical Life, a place where each week we talk about the intersection of ethics and modern life. I'm Scott Rotta, social media manager for Lee Enterprises, and I'm joined as always by Rick Kite, who is the head of the Ethics Institute at Viterbo University in La Crosse, Wisconsin. Hi, Rick.
Hi, Scott.
We all want to live happy lives, but it seems a lot of us don't know exactly how to do it. Rick, social scientists have spent immense amount of time trying to figure out what makes us happy. In fact, this week I read a really interesting story of what was called the world's longest scientific study about happiness, and we'll get to that in a second. But it seems there aren't nearly enough happy people in the world. With all this attention, why do you think that is?
Yeah, we have a lot of studies on happiness, but Gallup global surveys also show that unhappiness has been increasing pretty steadily in the world over the last 20 years or so.
And so I guess starting off, this is not just an American-made thing.
No, what they're doing is they call it negative experience index or something like that. And what they're looking at is emotions like or feelings like anger, stress, sadness, also physical pain and worry. And those are all at an all-time high globally. And so these are different things. You could measure, like, what are the things that make somebody unhappy are oftentimes different than the things that they report that make them happy. Those are two different things. And one is, you know, like basic kind of economic, physical conditions and so forth can cause a great deal of unhappiness. So if you're suffering from diseases or you're always economically worried, you don't know where your next meal is coming from, these sorts of things, of course, you're going to be unhappy. Once you get a number of your basic kind of physical conditions satisfied, the things that make you happy are very different. And that's mainly what, you know, studies of happiness in the United States look at, are what are those things, once you satisfy basic kind of physical needs, what are the things that you can do then to make a difference in your life?
And I think it's good in a way that we're studying this so much because we all want to be happy. But I worry a little bit, though, that these things that are being studied are, you know, great, but are not really shared among the population. So, like, maybe some people have some great ideas, but how is that information getting out? But, you know, as I say that, I think to myself, if there's one thing we have a tremendous flood of in this country are self-help books. So maybe I'm wrong entirely. Maybe there's just an overabundance of people out there trying to sort of unlock that key to happiness. One book, and I don't think it's fair to call it a self-help book, but one book that we'll talk a little bit about today is called The Good Life by Robert Waldinger and Mark Schultz. And it is about a Harvard study of adult development, and it's been going on since 1938, and that's what I mentioned at the top of the show, that it is sort of framed as the world's longest scientific study about happiness. And it was impressive, I mean, just to read about this study, the lengths they have gone to try to connect with these people, to really get to know them, to get to know what is important in their lives, and really, I guess, as best anybody can tell, to try to determine what makes someone have a happy and fulfilled life and maybe what doesn't.
Yeah, it's a really significant study, and it's good to, you know, see the results of study that over a long period of time like that. One of the things that psychologists have discovered is most people have an emotional set point, so that the various things that happen to you in life, they tend to make you temporarily more or less happy. But you return to normal. So when somebody wins a lottery, they're really happy for a few days, maybe a few weeks, but then they're back to normal. So, like, if as I experience, I just found out that my car was that I thought was in fairly good shape and had several more years left in it was basically totaled because of a rusted frame. Well, that made me feel really bad for a few days, but then, you know, then you get over it. So this is the point. So many of the things that we focus on that we kind of work to try to achieve through our days, we put a lot of our emphasis on, a lot of our kind of worry and concern are over things that end up not really moving us up or down very much on a happiness scale.
And as you say that, I mean, you know, you use the lottery example, and I've never been lucky enough to win, you know, tens or hundreds of millions of dollars in the lottery. So I don't know what that's like, but I would imagine that I would be happy for a little longer than a couple of days, but you're saying that maybe not. And obviously we've all been through things that are setbacks in our lives that make us unhappy for a while. And you mentioned we sort of have this set point. I guess that's probably a good thing, right? I mean, I guess you could argue that wouldn't it be great if when bad things happened, we always kind of returned to zero. But then when great things happened, we just sort of stayed up in that higher level. But maybe that sort of elasticity that we all have is sort of helpful because it makes us who we are.
I think it's a good thing because we generally can recover from real setbacks. What I find fascinating also is that there are certain things that you can do that change your set point. Like they'll move you up on a maybe not a permanent basis, but for a considerably longer move your happiness level either up or down. And one of those is spending time with friends. So if you regularly spend time with friends, your happiness level is going to move up and stay up.
And that was really sort of one of the big takeaways from this Harvard study, right?
Absolutely. And on the other hand, if you like lose your best friend or a very good friend and you don't find new friends to replace them, your happiness level is going to go down and stay down. This is why I think maybe we have more unhappiness than we would have to have is even among people that are kind of materially fairly prosperous, they don't really know what makes them happy. And so they focus on the wrong things. And right now we're living in a world where it's increasingly easy to be more isolated, where our communities are more fragmented. We have a lot more diversions, entertainment diversions and things. So it becomes pretty easy to just go home and watch TV and to be fairly satisfied hour to hour, right? But overall, our lives lack kind of drive and meaning and focus when we don't have close relationships. And those take work. So to be happy, to kind of move our set point up and make it stay there, requires a real intentional effort.
Two things I wanted to come back on that you said, because I think this is important stuff to spend a little time on. One, you mentioned how it's important that we all have these interactions and build relationships with people. And again, that was one of the main takeaways from this story and from the article about this study in The Atlantic. And the line from The Atlantic that caught my attention, it said, good relationships lead to health and happiness. The trick is that those relationships must be nurtured. So I'm hearing that. And then, of course, I think to myself, well, geez, we spent, depending on the place and depending on the person, a year, maybe longer, of where we really sequestered ourselves from people during the pandemic, especially that first year before vaccines came out and none of us were quite sure what was going on and children weren't going to school. Many people were working from home. And there were all these situations where I think public health dictated we do things differently. I remember when that happened, though, that there were people I knew who were saying things, and again, this was often through social media or what have you, saying, gosh, where people are asking me to stay home and not go out and not socialize, where I can read books and spend time with the people or two I'm closest to, that's great. That, you know, and so like if you're an introvert, you hear that and you think this is like made for me, and maybe you feel differently 8 or 10 months later. But I guess the question though to you is, if you're an introvert or if you're an extrovert, does that relationship building matter differently depending on maybe how you're wired?
I think it does. And I wish I had because I get this question quite a bit, and I always say I'm going to look it up, you know, and actually spend some more time on this, because I think it's such a fascinating question. Being an introvert myself, I really value alone time, and it's for me, it takes a lot of energy to spend much time with people, and being
especially probably me.
Well, yeah, you especially. I'll have several hours of recovery tonight after we get done recording this. But as a teacher, I spend a lot of time with other people, and then I need a couple of days when I teach a really long class, like a weekend class, for example. The day after, I don't want to interact with anybody that day, and that's a typical kind of introvert response. On the other hand, I also notice when I get what I want, sometimes like an ideal vacation for me is just to go away out in the woods, or on a stream or something by myself. After a couple of days, I get real grouchy. And so in a way, it's pursuing what I want kind of intuitively I'm seeking. And yet, if I don't have social interaction, my mood gets worse and worse as time goes on. And so I think oftentimes introverts don't realize how much we need to socialize with others. Maybe not as much as extroverts, but we still need it.
And I would suppose, and I think I'm probably more extroverted on that scale, but I think the same could also be said in reverse, that although I find it great to be around people and that can at times energize me, you can't do that all of the time just because you get a little burnt out of that too.
One of the statistics that really stood out to me in this Atlantic piece was that in 2018, the average person spent 11 hours a day on solitary activities. And what they found is that over a 29-year period, on average, the people they studied spent 58 days with a friend, but 4,851 days interacting with media.
Yeah.
I mean, that's out of all balance, right? And this basically is why we see increasing unhappiness. I mean, apart from, kind of real physical needs not being met, even among people who are relatively well-to-do, we're spending way too much time alone interacting with media, not enough time in social activities and cultivating genuine friendships.
One thing I also wanted to come back on, I mean, we're obviously having an episode talking about happiness, and we all know why that's important. And I think you said there's these set points that you can, that a lot of people have, and maybe you can make incremental adjustments to where that is. But in a lot of ways, that's sort of how each of us is wired. There's also people who I'm sure are listening, though, saying, geez, you guys keep talking about happiness like it's just so easy. And there are people who have depression issues and other mental illness issues where happiness is even a difficult or a more difficult reach than it is for those who don't suffer that. And I know your specialty is ethics, not necessarily mental health, but that's got to be a whole different set of challenges for people who deal with depression and other such challenges, sometimes day to day, sometimes hour to hour.
Yeah, it is. And one of the things we found, is like chemical imbalances can contribute to that. And so there's people for whom medications can really be helpful. The key thing is to keep in mind, like our social connections are important regardless of where we start. So whether we're dealing with depression or not, it tends to be that kind of rich social connections will make our lives better regardless of where we are. And so maybe happiness is the wrong word. It's not that we reach a state and we say, well, that's the state of happiness. It's that wherever we are in life, we're going to feel better about our lives if we nurture these rich relationships.
There was another piece, and we'll link to this too, that the Washington Post recently analyzed some census data, and it looked at which jobs seem to make people the happiest. And I was frankly surprised by this, and I bet you were maybe not as surprised as I was, but three jobs that, and I guess maybe it's because I would not want any of these three jobs, but three jobs that really were toward the top of the list: agriculture, logging, and forestry, all remarkably dangerous jobs, also seem to be the ones that make people the happiest. And when the Post looked further into this, they really found that the people who either work outside or really feel like their job has some sort of greater meaning are just happier in that position. And I suppose that makes some sense. I mean, isn't there some idiom that the people who are chiseling at stone picture cathedrals? Mm-hmm. You know, that they're the ones who, you know, that their job might seem rather menial, but they know that this, or conceivably this stone there, and maybe this is not how we do things anymore, but again, chiseling out of rock will someday be used to create something magnificent. And I think for some people, that's terribly important.
So I think doing work that is meaningful in the sense that you see yourself making some kind of improvement in the world. And so you are the agent of that kind of change from worse to better in some respect. So there's all kinds of crafts that do this. I think that's one thing that's kind of meaningful work and playing a role in it where you kind of have some choice in how that is done. That's also turns out to be quite important. The other thing that I found interesting about this study of, you know, like farmers and loggers and other people working outside, I think there's a real connection between beauty and happiness. And that wasn't mentioned in the article, but I think it's a subtext. What they find is that people who live on streets with trees tend to be happier than people who live on streets that don't have trees. Patients in hospitals that have a window looking out to the natural world, and especially like looking out at trees, that sort of scenery, tend to recover faster than those who don't. I don't think it's just outdoors. I think it's the presence of beauty. And I say that partly based on my own experience. When I was growing up, I used to help my dad, who was a house painter. And in the summertime, we would often be painting lake cottages because we grew up in an area of Minnesota where there was a lot of vacation homes, a lot of lakes. And so those days were just my happiest days because I'd be outside, we'd be on a lake, and it was beautiful. You know, we'd be in the morning and you'd have ducks and loons and things on the lake, and you know, and you'd get closer to evening and maybe the sun is setting and you there was just something that took you out of yourself being in that kind of environment, right? And reading the stories of like loggers who were talking about like the smell of pine sap, things like this that would, you know, they might be worried about something and then that smell would hit their nostrils and would just take them out of themselves and take their worries away. Well, this is what beauty does. It's in a way, it's elevating or transporting.
I mean, yeah, and you work on a perfectly nice campus and in perfectly nice classrooms, but they're not the same beauty you saw at the lakeshore painting a cabin. But at some point, though, I bet you don't sit back and think to yourself, "Geez, maybe I should not have spent my professional life enriching college students and learning deeply about subjects with which I'm interested in. Instead, I wish I would have rather stayed up in the North Woods painting cabins." I mean, do you think that some days?
There were times early on in my career where I still do in a way. I mean, there are times where I want to go work on something where I can see a result. Right, because teaching students, like every semester, I've got a new bunch of students, and I start from the same place. And even though, like in a way, you know, you're making progress, you're helping them develop, it's hard to see evidence of it, especially when you keep going back to square one.
It's not like painting a cabin,
right, where you actually see the improvement. So for me, this is what certain hobbies do. Mm-hmm. And the other thing is, frankly, I spend a lot of time outdoors, and I feel like it's really important for my well-being to occasionally get out of these indoor environments where tensions tend to build and where you can start ruminating on kind of the same old problems over and over and over. And if I can go take a walk for somewhere for an hour and completely get away from that, I come back refreshed and things are in a better perspective. I don't have the same worries and concerns. And so I can see where people that work outdoors on a regular basis, yeah, they just tend to be happier. Now, that doesn't mean I'd automatically want one of those jobs, right? Mm-hmm. But it makes perfect sense to me.
Well, and I talked a minute ago about how the pandemic affected different people. And I think for many, many people, for reasons we all understand, the pandemic sent folks outside, especially that first spring and summer and into the fall. And you saw reports where state parks and bike paths and hiking trails were really busier maybe than they'd ever been. And some of that went down the next summer, but it's still, and I think even still was increased. So I wonder if that is sort of one of those strange silver linings, is that the pandemic did sort of reacquaint people with the beauty of the outdoors and the recreational opportunities that you get. I mean, I think I've talked about on the show before, I used to be on my bike here and there once in a while, but that every summer of the pandemic and every summer since, I have spent more time on my bicycle than I ever have in any summer in my entire life. And I think I'm not alone. I mean, you walk into bike shops and bike shops were like out of bikes, like really quickly. Mm-hmm. So I guess it is interesting to me to see if people just now discovering those things or rediscovering those things will sort of in some ways boost that happiness quotient in the years ahead.
I think it will, but also the loss of social connection that happened, I see a lot of that continuing. And this is when I said before about people not being intentional enough about their lives, and this is one of the causes of unhappiness, I noticed during the pandemic that a lot of people, once we started doing isolating, they didn't work really hard at finding ways of maintaining their social connections, because there's ways of meeting outside and so forth. And I'll give you an example. I have breakfast once a week with a group of men. There's five of us that get together, and we decided, like early days of the pandemic, and you know, it could be, I think it started in March of 2020. So then, like in April and May and June, we were gonna every Wednesday morning take a walk somewhere. We'd meet on a trail at a trailhead, and we would take a walk. And so we're still kind of, as they were recommending at the time, you know, we were distancing, but we were still socializing and we were doing it outdoors. And those were great walks. We had great times and great conversations, but we maintained our friendship through it. And I met all kinds of people who their response, especially in the early days of the pandemic, was just to stop. Oh, we can't do what we've been doing anymore. Instead of saying like, well, we know that social connection is really important for our well-being. How can we do it now? Is there a way to do it differently? One of the things that's happening is our societies, I mean, we have so many broken communities right now. We have communities that are not well designed for people to do social interaction. We have neighborhoods that are built without sidewalk, that where it's hard to go out and even meet your neighbors. And we have many of the smaller towns are experiencing economic deprivation, where it's harder to have the kind of disposable income that allows you to do more socializing. And so it becomes more important to intentionally seek out ways of meeting other people. Not enough of us do that and do it well.
Oh, this topic of happiness is something you wrote a column about this week that goes into even greater detail than we'll be able to go into in this podcast. But you gave me an early look at the column, and there's one line that I'm going to read back to you that just I thought really hit me as an important line, and I think in please correct me if I'm wrong, but sort of outlines and sets the tone for what a lot of what you're saying in the column is about. You write, "Once we stop looking at what happens to us as an affirmation or rejection of our egos, and instead learn to see it as a test of character, the world begins to wear a very different appearance."
Yeah, this is a kind of a basic Stoic principle that you don't personally invest yourself in the outcomes of the world or even in the outcomes of your own actions. Like things happen, but they often have very little to do with you. And they don't even, they aren't really, they're certainly not a reflection on your character, what happens. But what you do, what you intend, that's what's really important. And once you put your emphasis on, like, what kind of person am I going to be? How will I respond to events? Not, will the events themselves make me happy or sad? No matter what happens, how will I kind of maintain my composure, maintain my level of, say, friendliness with other people, my ability to be compassionate towards those who are suffering and so forth? How can I maintain all that in spite of whatever happens to me? That, in a way, is very liberating.
And what, and I'll tell you a small story, what it made me think about. And it was something that was in December. And I had a medical appointment for, honest to goodness, like about as minor of a medical problem as you can have. I mean, it was nothing anyone should be worried about. And I wanted it to be handled over the phone. It wasn't. I had to go in. It was snowing. That was a pain. And then they ended up giving me a minor prescription for this thing. So then I had to go to the pharmacy, and I go there, and it was like a 45-minute wait for this medication. And I finally get home like an hour and a half later in this snowstorm, and I was just mad. And of course, I wasn't mad because I had this very minor medical issue. That wasn't why. I just kept thinking, well, geez, I should have been able to do this over the phone. And I just don't know why the pharmacy can't be better staffed. And this, what took me an hour and a half or 2 hours of my life that I'm never going to get back, I was just upset with the whole thing. And I come home and I'm telling Travis all this. And he says, well, you know, you control how you react to this. And that was good advice, because yes, I'm sure if my job were to make medicine and pharmacies more efficient, maybe there's something I could have had a takeaway out of that experience, or probably not. But that isn't my job. And my job was to deal with a very minor medical issue and deal with it in the best way I could, and probably be thankful that I had a job that allows me to go see a doctor whenever I want, and I don't have to worry about how much this might cost me, and that the medicine is available and I'm going to be fine. That's what I should be thinking about. I shouldn't be thinking about how inconvenienced I was, but of course, that was all I was dwelling on. And I think that's what you're saying, is that how we react to things. And in this case, of course, now, you know, 6 weeks, 8 weeks later, a really minor thing, I look back and say, gosh, I really blew that out of proportion. But I was like, came home and, you know, I was just mad.
And you could have stayed mad for hours, right? Mm-hmm. I mean, like, oftentimes we can have little things, especially if it's a number of little things that go wrong that kind of upset our expectations. It's basically what, so it inconveniences us, remember? And especially if we think that other people aren't doing their job, or they're being inconsiderate or incompetent, something like that, that can really piss us off. Then you said something key. You said, and that's like several hours of your day that you weren't going to get back. But then you yourself will ruin even more hours of your day that you will never get back.
Yeah.
And that's completely up to you to change your attitude about it. Because after all, you know, like that, that's the sort of thing that's going to happen on a regular basis throughout your life.
Yeah, that we do not have the world's most efficient healthcare system is not breaking news.
Right.
And that, yeah, and thankfully, for better or for worse, I'm the kind of person who I kind of get this out of my system, and like an hour later, I'm sure I was fine. But I just sort of had to like get that. Anger is probably a strong word, but get that unhappiness out there and sort of purge it. But I'm like, you know, but I never should have let it get to that level. I mean, there are things we should all be angry about, but this little incident I had was just not one of them.
Right. I think like stoic techniques for dealing with things like frustrations on the road, like you're going to go on the road, you know, you're going to meet people that sometimes are going to cut you off and things. And there's some that get genuinely really upset when they're driving and these things happen, or, you know, they encounter some traffic delay and then people are being rude about, you know, pulling past you in the passing lane and then trying to get, you know, merge in at the last minute, slowing the whole lane down. It's easy to be upset with this. Epictetus says something really interesting. He says, at the beginning of each day, just tell yourself, today I'm going to meet rudeness and insults and incivility and all kinds of things. And that's just the kind of world I live in, and that's what I should expect. But the test for me is not whether I get upset about those things. The test is, like, can I maintain my composure knowing that that's what's going to happen today? And then when those things don't happen, because they don't happen every day, well, fine. Then I go in. But when they do, you just say, well, I knew that was going to happen. So these are little things the Stoics would do. They would propose that you do these little thought experiments that prepare you for the kinds of adversity you're going to face, so that when you do face them, say, well, that's just what I was anticipating anyway. I may not like it, but it doesn't really upset me all that much.
And you even say that the word Stoic or Stoicism is sometimes misunderstood by people, thinking it's one thing, but in at least in a philosophical discussion can mean something a little different.
Well, yeah, I think the common meaning of Stoicism now, or being Stoic, means to be without emotion, right?
Yeah, and sitting there quietly, not reacting to something.
Yeah, and I've read pieces where talking about how boys today are taught to be too Stoic. They're taught like not to show their emotions, not to cry. So this idea of being Stoic means never crying, for example. This is just wrong. The classical Stoics, you know, like Epictetus, Zeno, Seneca, Marcus Aurelius, people like that, their thought is you don't want to have emotional attachments to things that are outside of your control, because then what you're doing is you're turning over control of your life to forces outside of you. And what you ought to do is put your focus and your attention onto the things you can control, which is your own attitude and your own behavior. That's, I think, exactly right. That's really important to do, which means that, I mean, you can be quite passionate about certain things, but you'll be passionate about what you do, not what happens. So I'll give you like a kind of maybe a silly example, but if you're playing golf and you hit a really bad drive, you hit a bad slice, it hits a tree and it bounces off the tree onto the green. Should you be happy about that or not? Well, most golfers would say, oh, great, that turned out great. And the Stoic would say, no, I hit a really bad shot. Like, it turned out well, but I need to work on my shot because I didn't put in the effort or the focus I should have.
And next time you probably won't hit the tree.
But say you make a really great drive and it hits a sprinkler head and then it bounces into the rough. Stoic would say, I made a really good shot. Right? Wouldn't worry too much that, you know, that it's not the score that's going to motivate the Stoic. It's the performance, which is like, how do I act in the playing of it? And this is how, like, all of life is like this, is a kind of performance or a game in which you're always being tested. Like, how do I always focus on what my behavior is going to be like in the moment? Also knowing that I don't really control how others perceive what I do or like what results from many of my actions.
And although Stoicism is far from a new philosophy, you say that it's getting newfound appreciation, especially in the world of high tech?
Yeah, there's a lot of interest in Stoicism in the Silicon Valley area over the last, I would say, 20 years or so, and it seems to be, you know, just kind of gradually increasing. But there's little pockets of, you know, communities of people that are talking more about Stoicism online, and I think, you know, like also in person. I think there's a couple reasons. I think the world is getting in some ways more complex, and we're starting to feel as if there are more and more things outside of our control. And in a situation where it seems like the external world is less under control, it's comforting to have a philosophy that says, well, what can I control? I can control my own attitudes, my own thoughts and judgments and behaviors. And so this is surrendering some kind of like seeking satisfaction in external events and exchanging that for a seeking satisfaction in my internal attitudes. I think the other thing that's driving it probably is the increase of religious nuns, that the N-O-N-E-S, you know, people that don't identify with any religion, many young people may not find any meaning in religious, kind of traditional religious practices or communities, but they're still seeking some kind of way of thinking about their lives that provide more meaning. And Stoicism does that because it's not a religious view, although there's many aspects of Stoicism that may seem religious, and there's many religious traditions that practice certain versions of Stoicism. But Stoicism, as it was traditionally conceived, the classical Stoics were not religious.
You're the expert on philosophy, and we spent a chunk of time here talking about Stoicism and frankly, how that relates to happiness. Is there a conflicting view? I mean, is there another group of philosophers who would say, no, in fact, what we've just got done saying is all wrong? Stoicism is not the answer. In fact, it's something else.
Well, that's an really interesting question, because I'm going to give you a kind of a long answer to say in the end, like, Christianity offers an alternative to Stoicism. And there are some other philosophers who maybe wouldn't say that they're Christians, but are really concerned about emotions like love and compassion and affection for other human beings. Because the classical Stoics really seem to de-emphasize relationships. Because, of course, they're saying you shouldn't be too focused, too emotionally attached to anything outside of your control. Well, other people are outside of your control, and so that seems to imply an emotional distancing from other people, even maybe from your partner or your children, right? And there is really something to that. In fact, a lot of the Stoics wrote in ways that seemed to be pretty callous towards family members even. St. Augustine was a, the early, Christian bishop of North Africa from the 4th century. He was a Stoic as a young man for a number of years, and then he seemed to abandon it because he didn't think there was enough emphasis on love, and that was partly responsible for his conversion later on to Christianity, was that there was a real emphasis on love of neighbor. And so these ideas of friendship and love of neighbor seems to be something that is incompatible with classical Stoicism. Another way of looking at it is it should be added on to Stoicism. And that's the way I regard it. I think Stoicism is quite valuable in helping us to think about how we should have an emotional distance from things like wealth and possessions and, even what other people think of us, our reputation. But we should invest emotionally quite strongly in other people and developing kind of emotions of compassion and care and concern for others, that's really worthy.
We end each show by tackling an ethical dilemma, and Rick, here is my question for you. A family moves into a nearby house after it was recently sold. How much online sleuthing do you do about your new neighbors before you meet them?
None.
None.
So do you have another dilemma?
That's it, huh?
That's okay. It. That's the answer. None.
Okay, so you might, this is, the reason I ask is, and as you might have guessed, there, we both live in similar type neighborhoods, lots of single family homes. Mm-hmm. And in my case, there was a really good neighbor, actually, who moved out of town and his house went on the market and was sold very, very quickly. And of course, he actually had a little going away party, the neighbor did. So I'm trying to like pump him for information about the new neighbor. So what do you know? He's like, yeah, I don't really know anything. So of course, the transaction goes through. Now, as a journalist, I know maybe a few more things about government records than probably regular people do. And I'm sure every state's different, but we're in Wisconsin, and in our particular county, like within a day of that real estate transaction being complete, there was the county website gets updated. So I had this person, so I looked and got the person's name. I'm like, and I get, maybe I hope you're not listening right now, but then I'm like, oh, I wonder, we live in a town of, that's not too terribly huge, and a lot of people know people. So I ran them through Facebook, and we didn't have any connections, but and I didn't go a whole lot further than that. But, you know, if I would have come across somebody who, you know, we had in common, I thought that would have been like a good icebreaker. But then again, how do you have that conversation? Like, hi, new neighbor. So I hear you know Fred. You know, I don't know how that happens exactly.
Right. That's, I think that's why I would say none.
You don't want to know. I mean, you would look out the window and see them carrying boxes and maybe get a sense of if they have kids or an approximate age of the person. And but other than that, you don't care.
And go meet them and say hi. But I think I would want to meet them in person and get an impression that way before I got any kind of online impression.
So you said blanket no. So, but if, okay, let's say, and I don't know what your wife would do, but let's say your wife happens to find out the name of the new neighbor and puts this on Facebook. Again, she might not ever do this, but let's say she did. And she said, oh, the new neighbor is friends with the Larsons and we're friends with the Larsons. In fact, we're going to see the Larsons for dinner this weekend. Let's ask them about our new neighbor. What would you say to your wife?
Oh, that's fine.
Okay.
Yeah. That would be different. I have a resistance to what you call the online sleuthing, the looking up in that way. I think, but maybe social media. I mean, people. I mean, this is largely information that people volunteer.
Yeah, I'm not worried necessarily about like safety issues that this person's coming out on parole for killing seven people. I'm not worried about that.
The only time I would think like I might want to do some online investigation of somebody is if I notice suspicious behavior early on from a neighbor, then I might want to find out. I need to know a little bit more than what they're revealing. And I've talked to some people who've turned out to have neighbors who were pretty sketchy characters, and it was good that they looked into those things.
Yeah, and I guess I'm not thinking about like checking court record sites. I'm more like just thinking, where do they work? What kind of, you know, do they have kids? Things like that. I mean, so I'll just ask you one other question since we have a minute here. So you're not going to look around. You said declaratively that you're not going to do any little online detective work. Let's say, though, that you see your new neighbor talking to an existing neighbor and they're having what appears to be a nice conversation, but you're just can't interject because you're heading out to go somewhere or whatever the case is, you can't be part of that conversation. And you run into your existing neighbor a few days later. Do you ask questions like, oh, I saw you met the new guy on the block. Do you try to pump him from information?
Yeah. And I think that's something that you want to do. I mean, I think it's good to get to know your neighbors and to find ways of meeting them and getting a little, I would want to know that sort of thing.
But you wouldn't check like I did the real estate transaction website a day or two after the transaction goes through and plug their name into Facebook and see what you can find out.
No, I don't think I would. And that seems to me like, you know, those 70s sitcoms that like every single one of them had a nosy neighbor. That seems to be like the new version of the nosy neighbor is one who like goes and looks up online very quickly to find out.
But you did admit though that you would like to get to, you know, presumably want to get to know the person, and when you get to know people, you learn things about them. That seems different to you somehow than doing things online and kind of in a little more covert manner.
Yeah, because I wouldn't be, if I ran into another neighbor, you know, that happened to meet them, I wouldn't be pumping them for information either. I would participate in a conversation and hear a little bit more.
Like, oh, I saw you met the new neighbors and kind of like have it open-ended. And if they, you know, say, oh yeah, they seem great or they seemed real weird or whatever the case might be, you can take that for what it's worth.
I think this might just be a personality difference and not anything that I would have an ethical objection to. Like, I don't think I would think badly of you for looking online on Facebook and seeing like who your neighbor's friends are and if you had any friends in common. That's just fine. I probably wouldn't do it.
So if you were my new neighbor and we didn't know each other, and I walked up to you and said, hi, I want to introduce myself. I'm the new neighbor across the street. My name's Scott, and your name is, well, Rick. Good to meet you. And by the way, I found out on Facebook that we have 17 friends in common. What would you, that was my first sentence to you. What would you think?
Oh, Mrs. Kravitz.
Well, I guess that probably says it all. As a reminder, the Ethical Life podcast is a production of Lee Enterprises. Please subscribe to the Ethical Life on Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, or Spotify. And be sure to check out Rick's column about ethics and happiness on all Lee newspaper websites. For Rick Kite, I am Scott Rada. Thank you for joining us.
For the ones who work hard to ensure their crew can always go the extra mile, and the ones who get in early so everyone can go home on time, there's Grainger, offering professional-grade supplies backed by product experts so you can quickly and easily find what you need. Plus, you can count on access to a committed team ready to go the extra mile for you. Call, click Grainger.com, or just stop by. Grainger, for the ones who get it done.
So I know you've got a lot going on, but remember, I'm here for you. So bother me when no one's listening, because I will. Bother me when it feels like it won't get better, because it can. Bother me because you're never a bother. Whether it's a low point or a crisis, get help for yourself or a friend. Learn more at neverabother.org or call or text 988, available 24/7.